Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I've chosen as my subject for today the financial stability role of central banks. One of the consequences of the recent financial crisis has been a rediscovery, or at least a renewed appreciation of that role. If we think back to the pre-crisis period, it seems fair to say that most of the public attention given to central banks was really focused on the monetary policy function, by which I mean the regular adjustment of the short-term interest rate in pursuit of inflation control. As important as that is, I think it's fair to say that the financial stability role of central banks has gained a great deal in prominence since the crisis. We can see that in several ways. Central banks played a crucial part in the initial crisis response by providing emergency liquidity support where it was most needed. In many cases, they held direct responsibilities for dealing with troubled institutions, or else they needed to cooperate very closely with the agencies that held those powers. And since the crisis, they've played a key role in developing the post-crisis regulatory strategy. A number of governments around the world have taken steps to strengthen the financial stability mandates of their central banks, and in some cases, they have given them additional powers to that end. One commentator recently described all of this by saying that the financial stability role of central banks has been rediscovered with a vengeance. What I want to do today is to explore what that might mean in practice. The first point I want to make is that the financial stability role for central banks is not new. Economic historians point out that financial stability was one of the original core functions of central banks when they first developed in the 18th and 19th centuries, arising from their unique position as lenders of last resort to the banking system. Banks are intermediaries that engage in credit evaluation and maturity transformation in order to link borrowers and lenders. In doing that, they perform a function that is vital to modern economies, but the historical record shows that without proper supporting arrangements, banking systems can be unstable. One source of that instability that became evident early on in the development of banks was their vulnerability to runs and panics. To put it simply, even a sound bank could be at risk if it was forced to liquidate its assets in a crisis. And the best defence against that was to give them access to a central source of liquidity. Central banks evolved, or else they were created by governments in order to meet that need. Historically, that role had important synergies with other central banking functions and with other aspects of what we now think of as financial stability policy. A basic requirement was to manage the monetary system in a way that would reduce the risk of panic and crisis in the first place. It also meant applying the famous Badgett principle that central banks should lend freely at a penalty rate on good collateral in the event of the system coming under stress. The liquidity management role of central banks in that sense also led naturally to their engagement in other areas of financial stability policy, including having a degree of oversight over the banks that they were potentially lending to. Obviously, the world now is very different from the 18th and 19th century world that I've just described. But I began with that background to emphasise an important point of historical continuity, and that is that central banks today still have a key role as liquidity providers to the system, and that function continues to have important synergies with other aspects of financial stability policy. How then should we think about financial stability policy in the current environment? And how should we think about the role of central banks within that in particular? Well, today I want to offer some general thoughts on that question, while also acknowledging that this is not an area for simple answers. When economists talk about policy frameworks, they often like to think in terms of a taxonomy that has the following main elements. First, the objectives, or in other words, what is the policy aiming to achieve? Second, the instruments. So, in other words, what are the tools that are available for achieving those objectives? Third, the strategy. What are the logical processes that link the instruments to the objectives? And finally, governance, or in other words, who makes the decisions and how are they held accountable? In the case of the monetary policy function of central banks, those questions have been well studied, and there's a fairly well-established consensus framework for how we should think about that. And I could summarise it, I think, as follows. The objective is inflation control. The instrument is the short-term interest rate. The strategy is to adjust the interest rate in response to changes in the inflation outlook. And the governance structure is that the government sets the objective and the independent central bank sets the instrument. And so there's a delegation of responsibilities from the government to the central bank. For financial stability policy, the position is much more complex, and it's much harder to come up with easy definitions of that sort. The objective might be defined as something like avoid financial instability or keep the risk of system-wide disruption to an acceptable minimum. But those things, of course, can't be easily quantified. There's no simple measure of financial system-wide risk, and the concept certainly can't be reduced to a numerical target in the way that it can for the inflation objective. And by the way, most fields of public policy are like this. Monetary policy, I think, is unusual in that the kind of quantification that I've just talked about is much easier to achieve. But all of this doesn't mean that the task is hopeless. We're better, I think, at identifying particular sources of risk like excessive leverage, poor credit standards, asset booms, than we are at aggregating them or forecasting their system-wide impacts. We do know financial instability when we see it. We have a good idea of the kinds of behaviour that contribute to it. And the objective is to manage those risks to an acceptable level. So much for the objectives. The second element is the policy instruments. Here again, the position is much more complicated than it is for the inflation targeting framework. There are many potential instruments of financial stability policy, not just one. I've already mentioned one of them, and that is the liquidity management capacity of the central bank. But there are many others. They include regulatory requirements that influence the risk-taking behaviour of financial institutions, and I'm thinking here of things like liquidity and capital standards. Those are things that might be termed structural prudential instruments, and they're aimed at promoting a generally robust financial system. In addition to those, there are things that we might term macroprudential tools. There's a growing interest in those. And these are tools that can be used in a time-varying and targeted way to manage risks as they evolve. Examples of that might include things like maximum loan-to-valuation ratios for property lending or the countercyclical capital buffer aimed at general credit cycles. And both of those are things that are being debated internationally at the moment. In addition to all of those, what you might call hard-edged instruments, we should also remember that the prudential supervisors have a strong capacity to influence and respond to banks' risk-taking in less tightly defined ways without the use of prescriptive rules. In Australia's case, I think we've been well served by APRA taking a proactive approach on this front to ensure that risks in the banking system are well understood and well managed. I think of all those informal modes of influence as a policy instrument in terms of my general outline, but it's not one that can be easily formalised or quantified. So that's my second element, the instrument. The third element is the strategy. How are the instruments deployed to meet the objective? Well, it should be clear from what I've said so far that the policy strategy in this area can never be as tightly defined as it can be for the central bank's monetary policy function. Nevertheless, there are some things that we can say about how the strategy should work and how internationally regulatory institutions are approaching it. And it contains the following elements. You need appropriate management of system liquidity, as I've already said, including a framework for providing emergency liquidity in a crisis. You need capital regulation to ensure that banks are well capitalised. You need good supervision to promote proper risk management in the banking sector. Sound risk controls for other systemically important institutions, including key providers of financial market infrastructure. Robust crisis resolution frameworks. Ongoing monitoring and analysis of system-wide risk, including things like leverage and asset prices. And you need appropriate coordination amongst the various regulatory policymakers. Regulators around the world are working to strengthen all of those areas that I've just listed, and I think that list captures the main common elements of the strategic approach. But there are also some significant differences in approach across countries, particularly when it comes to organisational structure. And that brings me to the fourth element of my outline, which is the element of governance, or in other words, who controls the policy instruments, who does what. I've already made the point that one part of the instrument set, which is the liquidity management function, is inherently a function of the central bank. Internationally, one of the areas of recent debate has been the extent to which that and other central banking functions should be combined with prudential regulators, or whether they are best kept separate. And if they're not combined, how can they best be coordinated given the synergies between these various functions? In current international practice, there are a range of different approaches to this question. Australia, of course, is a jurisdiction that has a single integrated financial supervisor separate from the central bank. Other examples of that structure are Canada and Japan. The United States and Europe have a complex set of arrangements that fall somewhere in the middle, where central banks have partial regulatory responsibilities, and there are also separate regulatory agencies. The UK has just completed a full transfer of prudential regulation functions back into the central bank after having separated them in the late 1990s. Indonesia is an example of a country that's in the process of making a move in the opposite direction to that. So clearly there are a variety of different approaches to the question of organisational structure. In many cases, including in Australia, central banks have a general mandate to promote financial stability, even if they're not the primary banking supervisor. A key consideration in all of this is the obvious synergies between central banking activities, prudential regulatory functions, and crisis management and resolution functions. The position of central banks in financial markets is likely to give them early visibility of many types of financial stress. Things go wrong. The place where you might first see that is in things that the central bank is first going to see. And their position as the system liquidity provider gives them an essential role in crisis management, as well as critical expertise in financial markets. For those sorts of reasons, there's a clear need for ongoing coordination of those various roles with the crisis management, resolution, and prudential supervision functions. But coordination is not necessarily achieved by organisational unity. arguments can be made for a range of different institutional structures, and it's perhaps not surprising that countries have come to differing conclusions influenced by their own histories and their experiences during the crisis. With that general background, I want to conclude with some observations about how we organise these things in Australia. In particular, to come to my original point, I want to ask, what is the role of the Reserve Bank in Australia's financial stability arrangements? It's sometimes said in answering that question that the Reserve Bank is Australia's macroprudential authority and APRA is the microprudential authority. The implication of that way of summarising it is that the bank looks at stability from a system-wide point of view, and APRA is concerned only with the individual institutions. I think to look at it in that way is at best an oversimplification, and really it's an unhelpful way of trying to summarise the respective institutional roles of those two agencies, because it's not really possible to separate the objectives in that way. The difference between the two roles, I suggest, is best understood in terms of their powers and responsibilities rather than in terms of their objectives. APRA does have powers that relate mainly to individual institutions, but its legislative mandate includes a financial system stability objective, and it can adjust its prudential standards to address system-wide concerns. The bank has a broad financial stability mandate, and it has its own set of powers that can be directed towards achieving that. In a legal sense, the bank is authorised to provide financial services to the government and to the financial system, and it has significant powers to engage in financial activities in the public interest. As I've said, those powers enable the bank to act as lender of last resort and liquidity manager for the financial system, in addition to its better known role in conducting monetary policy. When bank supervisory powers were shifted from the Reserve Bank to APRA under the Wallace reforms in 1998, the bank's general mandate to promote financial stability was reaffirmed. That was more recently emphasised again in the 2010 Statement on the Conduct of Monetary Policy, which is the agreed charter between the bank and the government. The Wallace reforms and subsequent legislative changes also gave the bank significant regulatory powers in the area of payment system resilience and financial market infrastructure. So the Reserve Bank and APRA have different powers, but they have overlapping and complementary objectives in relation to financial stability. It goes without saying that the two organisations have a strong appreciation of the need to work closely together and to coordinate with the other key agencies, especially ASIC and the Australian Treasury. There are a number of mechanisms, both formal and informal, for achieving that. At the peak level, the four agencies combined to form the Council of Financial Regulators, which is chaired by the Reserve Bank Governor. There are numerous other coordinating arrangements at the staff level. Although the Council is a body without formal powers, it's played a very important part in a number of different ways. They include information sharing, developing the overall post-crisis response, and providing coordinated recommendations to the government to that end. Internationally, I find that there's a lot of interest in the Australian coordination arrangements, and it's interesting to observe that other countries around the world have moved to put in place their own Financial Stability Council arrangements in the wake of the crisis. So to recap just very briefly, what I've tried to do today is to outline what I see as the main elements of financial stability policy, to explain why the central bank has a key role in that, arising from its role as system liquidity manager, and to highlight the need for coordination between the central banking role and the role of other agencies, especially the prudential regulator. I think the arrangements that I've just outlined have served Australia well. During the recent period of global financial stress, our banking system and our crisis management arrangements have proved more resilient than most. In the end, though, what counts is not the way financial stability policies are allocated to particular agencies, but the quality of their implementation. That, of course, remains the focus of the Reserve Bank, as well as for the wider body of regulatory agencies in Australia and abroad. Thanks once again for the invitation to speak today, and thank you very much for listening.